Okay, so here we are. And then now I'll share my screen. Can you hear?
Yes. Thank
Okay.
you.
Yeah, our AV system is still broken in this room. And so we're using my laptop. And so I have to figure out how to get everything on the screen here. Sorry. Okay, finally. Okay, good. We're on. So I was just like relating my personal vibe coding journey with the students, some of whom are ahead of me, and then but some of them out. And so Michael asked the question. What asked your question again?
Yeah, basically, like, how much do you defer to, say, Claude in making technical decisions on things that you don't fully understand? Like, how much do you just trust it to do your job for you? Is how much you want to both either understand yourself while looking over, or previously have like an idea of like how you go about it?
Right. So there's a couple things. So I think that there's an inversion. So maybe maybe I should write about some more of these things in detail. So the way I was using LLM assistance before this holiday was I would come up with the big architecture of what is going on, and then I would have the LLM like speed up little details or fix something, right? Oh yeah, it's a pain to like write this algorithm, but and I'll just plug it in, make a function for me, right? I think that might be an inversion of what these tools are good at. So I think of them as like earth-moving tools. And so when you're like building a house, there's a phase in the house when you bring in the huge bulldozers, right? And I'll give you a hint, it's not the last step. Right, it's like the first step, and so I think these things are really useful. I think they're more useful at the beginning than at the end. There's some value of them at the end as well, right? But I think they're more useful at the beginning when you're moving Earth around in a new project, because you can have them, quickly reshape the landscape, and show you sort of how things will look, and then you can be like, well, that's like a month of human effort, and but look at which way it's going. It looks like garbage. Throw it out. Let's try a different way. And you can like do a few months of work in rapid iteration, just moving big mounds of code around, in a way that you would never subject a human to, right? Because of the psychic pain of throwing away like a month of work. And so I think that so the thing that I was experimenting with over the holidays was there's two types of vibe coding. There's a type where you try to maintain architectural control of the whole thing, and then there's this other type of vibe coding where you just let the thing architect it. And I've been experimenting with the second kind, where like somebody said somewhere, like if you look at the code, you're doing vibe coding wrong. I don't think that's the right word to say, right? But it's a little bit of the spirit. Like there's two types of vibe coding. There's a type of vibe coding where you're looking at every line of code, and there's a type of vibe coding where you're thinking very consciously of the challenge of what you do when you're not looking at every line of code. And so instead of looking at every line of code, I write like four times more tests than I would normally. I have it write much more detailed design docs. I have multiple agents look at the code simultaneously to give me different perspectives on it. I'm constantly refactoring it to make sure that the implementation is robust, even though I must like look carefully at it. And I'm hypersensitive to certain types of bugs, and I don't like the agents slough off on them. And so it's still hard. There's still problems. Like, so in my Matterbot thing, I was like, oh man, I can't believe it. The agent at some point, I don't know where during the commit history, like added some, assumed that I wanted a certain thing and added some logic that I didn't want, right? And I hadn't noticed it for 100 commits. I'm like, please back that out. Like, that's not the point of what I'm trying to do. Like, messed up one of the core points. And so the agents will like miss important things. It's very challenging to do it. But so it's this weird thing. I don't know if I totally, I don't totally advocate it, but I advocate like figuring out how to navigate this difficult thing. It's not foolproof, right? There are problems with it. That makes sense. But it's also like but it's pretty clearly also the future. So people will figure out how to solve these problems. I think that you guys, can work on figuring out how to solve that. It's actually a potential research question, how to navigate some of these problems. Make sense? So, okay. Next slide. Who's next?
Like in the Discord, we were saying maybe a good idea would be to have like a lab-wide session or something where like someone if someone feels like they have a really good setup and have a grasp on like the tooling and
Do you have a good
software.
setup?
I'm not sure.
You probably have a pretty good setup. Anyway, or maybe you
Like
have a good
this
setup. I
one.
don't know.
But yeah, Michael was saying maybe like
Yeah.
a good intuition is. But
Yeah, it's great.
it might be a good idea just for us to exchange like what everyone's doing, what you
Yeah.
find helpful, what
Yeah.
tools people are using.
Maybe organize something adjacent to reading group or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that'd be
Do you
cool.
think weekly?
Oh, you think weekly? No, I just thought just once,
Oh
but
well, who knows
but
fully.
who knows at this point? There could be an ongoing research group. So I do think that there's there's potential for research here. And so I think Gabriel's starting to push on a couple research questions. And so if you're interested in doing research in that direction, then we do have one lab member who's thinking about this type of thing on an ongoing basis. But for just practical reasons,
Yeah,
there's
just for
more.
like day-to-day efficiency.
Okay, cool. All right. Excellent. So do you want to set up time now?
We were thinking 3 p.m. today,
Oh, 3 p.m.
but
today.
or
Yeah.
should we do a different Friday?
Yeah, it was just an
Yeah,
arbitrary
why don't we do 3 p.m. today?
okay.
All right.
Yes.
Done. Okay.
If you go too ahead, there's
Oh, there's
kids animations with
oh you have animations.
no good reason why.
Whoa. Whoa.
Okay, so this
Okay.
is from my presentation yesterday for the neural mechanics class that David's teaching. And the setup of the class is that we're in teams and we have a like subject matter expert who's outside of CS. So my team has a political scientist on it, and we're looking into, trying to understand how some concept is represented in LLMs that has to do with their subject matter expertise. And so we were looking at like political bias or political leaning broadly construed. And so we've all been sort of banging our heads against like reading all these different papers that have been done about political bias in LLMs. And I think that what happened is we just sort of had like proliferating confusion about the situation from both a political science perspective and from an interpretability perspective. So from the political science perspective, Emery, the PhD student in political science, he was like, people are being too narrow when they just think of these left-right axes. We need this like multi-dimensional framing, and there's all these different approaches to how you frame political bias on that side. And then from my side, I was sort of like, even if we frame these things one way, I don't even know how to think about how these LLMs are representing, their own bias. Is that even a coherent thing, especially when you RLHF a model? Like, is it
Yeah.
doing something different? So we had these sort of weird things where it's like, he's really trying to clarify like what we should be looking for, and then I'm sort of trying to push like, but wait, even if we look for that, I'm not sure we know what's going on there. So
Yeah.
what we ended up with in our proposal was just this. I think the biggest confusion I had from my side was how much does like, is LLM political leaning a coherent thing, or is it completely entangled with the user, how the user presents itself? And how complicated is this entanglement? Like, is it truly modeling the user, or is it just doing some like next likelihood thing?
I love this class. It's like, and every one of the project teams has like things that they're wrestling with
Yeah.
that are like this. And
Along
so,
all the levels of abstraction and
so cool. Yeah, so cool.
so
Yeah, that's really nice.
yeah.
I'm glad you've been having this conversation about
It's fun, but it did lead to some very chaotic planning thoughts.
that.
But yeah,
Well, we've got
so
14 weeks to work it out.
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so
That's great. Okay, let's go next here. Oh, Rohit. No, who's, oh my gosh, what the heck? Holy cow. What is going on here?
I'm a teen for now.
What do you do over the holidays?
It looks like I'm married, but I'm not married.
You're not
That's
married.
just that's called an engagement party in India. That's when my parents officially considered that I'm engaged. They wanted to throw this party. But yeah, I'm gonna get married this year, so you're all invited. I'll send you more official invitations, but yeah. And if you yeah, I'm now joining the list of legends.
Oh.
Maybe this year, not yet. But yeah, and here like there are some technical stuff I have accomplished. Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, also this is like one of the technical stuff I've accomplished. This is a homemade delicacy from my hometown.
Oh, okay. Here, share one. Share one.
I've learned
What is
how
it?
to.
What is it?
This is called arisello.
Okay. Here.
I don't know how else to explain it, but it has something called jaggery. It's a healthier form of sugar. Yeah, you should. I have more of it, so you can like take two or three of them. Yeah, that's. I think that's a technical. I've done it. I've done the
Very nice. Very nice. Hey, Eric.
Yeah, I kind of have two things. So the first is I've been working on my website for the algebra project. I made this little widget. You can go to the website.
You gamified the whole thing.
Yeah, it's algebra.battlelab.info. And you can try out these little in context algebra problems if you want. There's hints. So if it's too hard, you can ask for a hint. I think the hints are pretty good. And you can ask for easy ones or hard ones. Hard one just makes it a longer prompt. You can sample through new samples. But pretty proud about that. Hoping to tweet about it at some point. Need to finish writing my tweet thread, but probably in the next day or two, it'll happen.
You code it yourself.
This is a with plot. Yeah.
Well, we got this.
But it's like, I think it's pretty good. Like, if you check the show hints, it'll like highlight examples in the prompt that will explain why you could solve that problem. Yeah, I'm pretty proud of it. Okay, and the second thing I've been thinking about is sort of a new project direction. So this is from a paper. I guess like the thing I've been thinking about is like what makes tokens like redefinable or exchangeable in a context. So this is from a paper where they're studying kind of a similar problem, but in terms of like well-known physics constants or like math constants. And so like pi has like this like canonical number of like 3.14, but then they like also try and like redefine pi as like 100 and see if language models can do this. And they try this for a bunch of different like constants. And I'm not sure I believe this, but like they say that larger models have a harder time overriding their prior of what these constants mean versus smaller models. It might just depend on the prompt too. So I've been playing around with like trying to reproduce because there's a lot of like inconsistent results, I think, similar to this, where like people will say it's hard for models to redefine this, or it's easy for models to redefine this in different contexts. And so I'm trying to figure out like what's a good setting to sort of pin this idea down.
It's cool. And is your idea that you do something different from these people because you're looking at the mechanism or something, or yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm interested in like a few things. So, well, one of them is like how a model like imbues new meaning into a token, or like how that works.
Okay.
So,
That's cool.
Are you interested only in like in context redefinition or like another way you might do this is like give it training data where like I it needs to learn how kind of
Yeah,
really needs
so
on purpose.
yeah. So there, so I guess there's, it's
another like line of work, there's been a few people that like train new tokens or like they like retrain a token with some new documents to like override it. I think those are both interesting. I'm not sure
Maybe
which one is
related.
more
It would be
interesting.
interesting if they have different methods.
They're both promising. So for this one, this is I guess supposed to be the figure one for the next paper. And I think I have a lot of questions about like aesthetics. That's something we're really it's I'm kind of struggling with. So like the idea of this figure is below is like the architecture for the model, which is a protein folding model. So like you put in a sequence and then it outputs a 3D protein structure. And then we're looking at the folding trunk. So it takes two inputs. One is like the sequence representation. So like each token of the sequence is just a bunch of embeddings. And then there's the pairwise one where for each token, you get a representation for every other token as well. So it's like the paired relationships. And so we're looking at like this folding trunk in the middle. And then our claim is that like there are these stages of computation. So that's what figure one's supposed to be. And I think there's like a lot going on. I guess like the main idea is that there's like the stage one is where like sequence information, like specifically the chemistry, flows into this pairwise representation, which starts out initialized with just positional embeddings. And then the second stage is meant where now the pairwise representation starts to build up like these distance maps. And so that's what I'm trying to show with like the proteins too on the top. It's like we have these icons where it's like, well, the sequence is like pointing up to this pairwise thing, and the pairwise thing is pointing down to the sequence. But the top is supposed to be like the proteins evolving in the model, and like it starts out as like it starts out as like something kind of random, and then it's supposed to fold a little bit, like mostly, and then like the red and the blue strands are supposed to be positively and negatively charged, and then that's when in the next stage, it uses that information to turn it into a structure, which is a beta hairpin, which is what we focus on in the paper, and so that's supposed to suggest like, oh, this is how the distance structure is like built up in this stage, and then the final one is the final protein. But that's like the story I'm trying to tell. It's just like there's so much going on. I'm not sure how to like make it clear and aesthetic at the same time. Do these have to be on the same figure?
Which like everything in the top half?
Like the top and the bottom half?
Oh, there's two separate figures.
Oh, so which one's the figure like?
The
Top
top
one?
one, yeah.
Like if you give the green picture of the protein to someone that is an expert in the plane, they can identify this. Like they can understand that this is being formed in that stage.
Do the colors mean something? The colors of the protein?
There no. So
Okay,
like
because
the
I think because it's changing color, that it's unclear to me if it's the same protein. But if it was like always the same color, then I would think it was the same object.
I guess I was trying to convey like orange is always stage one. So like for our entire paper, it's like orange refers to like the sequence representation like evolve or flowing into the pairwise. So that's why like it's supposed to be orange, and then I made the third one green. But the one in the middle is gray. And I was like trying to make them all similar like positions. It's like they're supposed to be oriented in the same way, but it is hard to tell that it's evolving. Like can you tell that the last three are the same, but then the first one?
No,
Oh,
I think
okay.
something about the color. I don't know why, but like
Yeah.
that when the
Okay,
color
that's
changes, I'm like,
helpful.
it's a different thing. Like, I wonder if like you could outline it or like shade
Okay.
behind it
So
or something.
you colored everything in green, but you have certain like parts of the protein that are illustrated in the like the highlighted colored, rows and columns of the thing. And I wonder if the thing to do is to make an uglier like circle this residue or draw a line between two residues or something like that and make that line be like that color in bold. And so like you have some colors here, but let's see here. So but it looks like a whole bunch of residues, and then also red and blue doesn't correspond to the purple. You have like so like the purple column and the red and the blue, like actually I don't know how to read this
Yeah, I guess that's
this
what it
little
is.
chart. What is every column and what is the
So
row here?
the columns in the
I guess you would read it as like, so the columns correspond to the letters on the bottom,
Okay,
and then you
and those are
would,
residues.
those are residues, and then the rows also correspond to those residues, but it starts like KLGEA from top to bottom. So that's why, like,
That's okay. And then what's the red thing representing?
the red is supposed to represent like at this, so the information from the E is not being projected into the pairwise representation. So every column or row that includes E should be colored red, because now they're all like they all include some negative charge, because E is a negatively charged residue. And then the same thing with K. So all the rows and columns that include K should be colored blue. And then when they intersect, that's purple, because that's like they're oppositely charged. So that's like the most important piece, which is why they become the hairpin in
So
this
do
case.
you think so? So on so the other beef I have is like the we talked about in the previous meeting, is like the names pairwise chemistry versus geometry. I don't love it. So would you think of this as distributing information and consolidating information?
Yeah, I guess we were thinking like this is the first stage is definitely some like it's definitely a feature extraction,
Yeah.
or like some information transfer,
Yeah.
and the second stage is more of like a consolidation.
Yeah, so maybe that would be clearer than chemistry versus geometry.
Do you are you okay with the geometry name? All right, we're definitely gonna get rid of the pairwise chemistry. But...
I see. So maybe you call it feature distribution, and then I'm not sure. Yeah,
And
g geometry consolidation.
Chris's one question was like, if we call it feature extraction, isn't that I guess it doesn't feel like it's different from what most of the literature does says, which like this is the stage that most people find at the beginning of like many model
That's
components.
okay. Do you agree with the literature?
He was like, oh, we want to be unique and like have the word chemistry. Okay, I was just checking your thoughts.
But
Also, how is
wait,
the
I'm here, guys. I'm here. My critique was if we just say feature enrichment, we don't add any information to what is already obvious, right? So, but we had a solution for this, which was feature enrichment, parenthesis, chemistry. Or parenthesis, e.g., charge.
Because it's not just feature enrichment.
Right. Yeah, we have like this.
Like
I mean,
actually.
or e.g., something, the word of the for the force that, you know, govern for which the charge matters. Like, to just add something, some extra info. What do they call it when things have a tendency to like each other, affinity, right? So would you say something like affinity propagation?
That's
What,
not
how
the
about affinity?
yeah, I guess it had affinity has a different like a very strong meaning for protein people,
Yes.
but I think like some sort of affinity or attractions like that. That's why that's kind of why I like chemistry though, because it's like
Very generic.
if two people are good together, they have chemistry. That's why I'm trying to, so but anyways, yeah, I think there's like I just wanted to get some feedback on this. I think it makes sense that the grid things are really hard to read, so I don't know about that. Maybe they don't even need to be there, and I'll just have the text and the protein.
No, I think it's good. I think the grid things are good, but the so there's a, so the position of the red highlight is, so you especially highlighted the diagonal, which is a little mysterious to me. Is the diagonal like a special place where like this is especially where you find the charge information?
I
Because
guess it was more so just like because on the diagonal, it's like if you're positively charged, then your other guy is also going to be positively charged because it's yourself.
yeah.
So that's why I thought like, oh, it should be extra blue, and like the and then the E should be extra red on the diagonal. But yeah, that's
But the interesting interactions are the purple
right.
points.
Yeah, that's the most. That's like the key piece. The purple.
Right. And then in your protein, is that literally one residue? This
The
long thing?
visualization is technically more.
Yeah. So I wonder if you line it up better so that it's like literally one residue that you like circle in blue, and then one that you circle in red, and then if you want to draw a purple line between them, then you've got like blue, red, and purple.
Okay, and you
Like
would
I'm
keep the
not sure.
grid.
What would you say?
You would keep the grid.
I think I keep the grid.
Get rid of the diagonal.
Get rid of the, okay.
Yeah, and yeah, I'm not sure.
You mean the green diagonal? Or what the
The red diagonal.
Yeah, the red diagonal, it's a little funny. Yeah, like how like what we do here.
You don't need it. Like
Yeah, it
just
doesn't need
color
to.
it the same as the background then.
Just right. So what's the so okay, so how do you communicate red and blue? Like, so actually you don't have what you don't have is you don't have a label row and a label column. Like your columns are just only the data, right? And so if you had a label row and a label column where you've got blue and red in the label columns, and then inside the grid you have these two purple things for the two interactions, then maybe it would clarify it. I'm not sure. Right. And then ask Stefan if you're allowed to use affinity. Are you not allowed to, like, is affinity you?
We haven't talked about affinity yet. I guess that's
Okay.
like my instinct though is
Yeah, ask him. And then or maybe look for a synonym.
yeah.
Yeah.
I'm just gonna thank you.
Is the
Okay.
graph below somehow related to the sequencing structure? Like, is that time axis? It doesn't look like it.
So, no. It's
It's
supposed to be
layer.
like
It's
a
layer.
metaphor for the time across
It's
the
layer.
blocks.
Layer.
It's layer.
And through the layers, you're seeing the structure
It's a, like,
take
that's
form.
the visualization.
Just
But
the
it,
folding trunk part.
yeah. But technically, that's not actually what happens. But, like, as a storytelling device, I'm trying to show, like, the protein is evolving.
I see.
I have one more comment on
Yeah.
the protein
It's a
lens.
little bit like the logit lens view, right?
Yeah, it's supposed to be like the logit lens.
The proteins, like the paper is just focused on this like beta hairpin thing.
That's true.
Like, can you just
Oh,
simplify the protein
yeah,
to
that's good, yeah.
just only be the beta hairpin strand,
Yeah.
just like 20 residues,
Yeah.
and get rid of all the other wiggly stuff
Yeah,
on the protein that's not a
and
protein.
then
Yeah,
it'd be very
simplify.
obvious.
Simplify. That's cool. That's cool.
And then you can have one side of the beta residue that's like blue and one
Yeah.
that's red. It's very zoomed in.
Yeah.
In the third protein,
Yeah.
like the fact that these two are very bright green and the rest of the protein is green, can the rest of the protein just be gray like
Yeah,
the previous
yeah.
one?
And just do like, yeah, gray.
Yeah, so that it's very clear that you're just highlighting
Yeah.
those, right? I mean, if you just read up the rest.
I don't know. I
Right.
think you just give it just to yeah,
Yeah,
just
so
say
yeah.
that. Yeah, just keep the whole thing simple. But then I do like the idea of like some of it gray and then just like two dots green that
Yeah.
correspond to your,
Yeah.
you
Two
know,
residues.
your tic-tac-toe board,
Okay.
right? So that there's this clear visual correspondence. And if there's supposed to be analogous to logit lens early exit decoding, then you could just literally make it a logit lens early exit decoding, right? Like you could do it. Does that make sense? And then you could actually label this is where these come from. This is an early
So,
exit decoding of the actual.
yeah.
Do you think it would work? Do you think
So
you would get visualizations that
I've
work?
done it before. I
You
guess like
cherry pick one that looks good?
the first 20 block, I could do something where it's like technically I could start at block 20 and then basically the first 20 blocks, if you try to decode with a
It's
chart,
terrible.
it's terrible.
Yeah. But then after 20,
Then
so
it's
like
like,
you only have space for four anyway, so you
that's
start
true.
at 20, right?
Okay.
Or something.
Yeah. And just like point up blocks. Yeah. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
something like that.
Okay.
Yeah. But then it's like real data and you can label it. You can say, you know, above is an early exit decoding of. So then now it's not like, oh, this is not like molecular dynamics. This is computational dynamics visualized through an early exit decoding,
Yeah.
right? Isn't that cool?
Yeah, I'm
Then it's
hopeful to
real.
find something.
Okay. All right.
That's good.
Natalie. Are you there, Natalie? I think you're muted.
Yes, I'm here. Is
Okay,
that me?
cool.
Is it my turn now?
It is your turn. You're oh wait, I just flipped to your slides. Can you see?
No.
Oh
but
no,
away.
it's not working. Maybe Zoom is being.
Oh yeah, I see, I see, I see.
Okay,
Okay.
cool.
But I changed it a bit,
Oh, you
so
changed it. Oh, okay, here. I'll reload.
okay, and now it's not me again.
No, where oh, is the order different
I
now?
yes, because I changed it, so I moved it
You moved it to the end.
to
Okay.
yes.
No problem. We'll come back to you.
Okay.
What? Oh, I skipped somebody? No, that's Kevin.
Oh, okay.
Eric, Kevin, Michael. Okay, Michael, your turn.
So here a little bit. The setting of what we're focusing on right now is studying the difference between how the assistant, rather in a context with instruct models where you have an assistant and you have a user, seeing if there are differences in how the I like representations differ when referring to like the assistant versus the user. So to kind of explain the setup, there's this data set called the Anthropic HHRLHF, which contains a bunch. I mean, there's different sections, but I focus on the helpfulness section, which basically just contains generated conversations between a user and assistant, where the user is just basically goal. The user is just like, have the assistant help you on something. And I took this data set and I annotated it so that all the pronouns are annotated. So there's an example on the bottom left, and I have it highlighted where blue is for basically annotations referring to the user. So, you know, the human tag is highlighted, but then also me is highlighted in the context of the human's conversation. And in the assistant conversation, you is highlighted blue because it's referring to the human, and vice versa for assistant. And so I was looking specifically at PCA, or I was using PCA to see if there is separation between these different pronouns. And so I, for Llama 3.370B instruct, I collected every single latent representation of each of the I and you pronouns across the whole portion of the data set I was working with. And I visualized it. And so what I found was that there is actually some separation between, or rather, there is seems to be a way to discern, to differentiate between the user being like the user referred to as I or you, like I as in if the user's talking about saying like I blah blah blah, and you if it's the assistant saying you referring to the user. In this picture here, that would be the green and the orange. So those two are corresponding to referring to the user. And then on the bottom with the red and blue, those would be representation or yeah, tokens referring to the assistant. So there is a degree of separation.
So assistant you is the assistant saying for you.
Yes.
So it's interesting. So the two uses of the word you are at corners up across from each other, and the two uses of the word I are at corners across from each other. They're actually kind of far, even though they're the same pronoun.
Yeah, and if you play, so there's a video here, and what you'll
Oh,
see
there's a
that,
video.
yeah, which shows across each layer. I chose there's a specific part of the model where it started to have the separation. So you'll notice at the start, the red and orange, which is you and you, are together, and vice versa, and likewise for I. And then this mix happens, and you start getting the I and you getting pushed together. And towards the end, I mean, right now it's sort of starting to mix, but you'll notice by the end things just kind of get all mixed up and hard to separate from each other.
But there's somewhere around two-thirds of the way through that it's kind of clear.
Which and Natalie was doing some more causal methods to try and find which parts of the model correspond to like the I and the you or the user and these et cetera. And it was also in the middle part of the model, so.
Nice. I like this PCA visualization. Now, did you, so as a technical thing, because I'm using it for the class, so did you run this on Endiff?
No,
Okay.
because I actually what I did was I I did a run on Hakone to grab all the activations, and then I stored them to disk. So now I don't even need to use GPUs.
I know, right? So the thing that I would really love to do is, have a version of this where you collect on NDIF, but then you don't get all the activations off the NDIF, but you just do the PCA itself on NDIF to reduce the data volume size before you download it. And so anyway, I'd like to sort of
I don't
prepare a
know if
bunch of,
is scikit-learn even available on NDIF.
I don't know.
I
No,
haven't.
but also PCA is not, I mean, I'm not sure. So we can see, like, there's, if PCA is not,
It should.
like PyTorch has PCA in it.
Oh, it does.
Yeah. So, okay.
Yeah, I did think about wanting to do it with NDIF, but
No,
I
I
think.
just, but I'm thinking about for tutorials to distribute to the class in a couple of weeks. So we have this as like a as a component of the class in a couple of weeks. Visualizing PCA, I'd love to give people a nicely coded example. I think it's a really, really nice one.
If I can interrupt, we are also looking for ideas of how we can ask research questions with that PCA will answer them. Are we a bit struggling with that? Like with causal mediation, it is more intuitive for me, but when going through PCA, so it gives an intuition, and we can see, okay, there is a separation. So there might be encoded the information of the speaker within the token of the you or I. Is it the assistant speaking or the user is speaking? But can we say something causally about it?
I don't think you can say anything on its own causally.
Okay.
It tells you about information separation, like linear separability.
So what kind of question do the PCAs answer?
But there is subspace steering as well.
Right. So you can that's very common, is to take a PCA as inspiration or to make a steering vector. But then it's a steering that's proving something for you causally.
Yes.
I think
Yes.
what the
Okay.
PCA gives you is sometimes it shows you how things may be represented. And Julian has an example in his master's thesis where he looked at variable assignment, and the PCA analysis showed like one cluster for every vertex on the hypercube. So, or for every vertex of the cube. So there were three variables, right? So they can have like values 0 and 1. So you can plot a cube for all of the combinations of zeros and ones.
Which shows you some independence, right?
So it was kind of counterintuitive to us that it would look like that.
But
We would.
I can reach the information through patching experiment as well. So what is the added value of the PCA?
You won't see the hypercube. You
I'm
won't see
missing
the cube.
something.
You don't see the cube. You think there is like one cluster for x1 equal 1 and another one for x1 equal 0. But in reality, it's sort of smooshed together with the other variables. So there are like different instances of x1 equals 0, x1 equal 1. But like, I think I can share the
My perspective is it's just triangulation, that there's it's different ways of looking at the data, and like what PCA can tell you that other things can't tell you is it can tell, so like, it's because it's looking for the dominant sources of variation. It definitely tells you the surprising thing, which is this is the one of the dominant things that the model is trying to distinguish at this moment. It could be trying to figure out all sorts of other things. It could try to be figuring out the gender of the speaker, which actually sometimes, like Natalie, were you on you were on the project?
Yes, yes,
We
yes,
brought up
yes. We
that we
saw
tried,
that.
yeah, like gender pops out. We're not looking at gender, right? The model's like all obsessed about what is the gender of the speaker, right? And that's the dominant thing in PCA.
Okay.
And so, but so it tells you that type of thing. So I think that even if it doesn't like completely tell the whole story, it triangulates and builds intuition. And so, we just have, we just, I think that's like, I think it's valuable.
I
But
placed it into random. It's a U math that we did, not PCA, but the idea is the same.
yeah.
I just wanted
Boom.
to, there's two things that it could be interesting here. With the PCA, you can do an error analysis for the kind of out of boundary examples, and it would be interesting to try to look like, okay, this mentioned
Okay.
it was kind of grouped in
Yes.
after of the U, and why is it so?
Yes. Oh, I see.
Yes, yes,
That'd
yes.
be
Interesting.
and then you can actually do causal tests or things like that on that,
Yeah.
like on those error examples. Is
Yeah,
it
exactly.
are those examples
And the other
make
thing that I
sense?
think would be very interesting is to look at how these kind of clusters change between pre-trained and instruction tuned models, because my assumption is that the instruction tuning kind of teaches the model not to talk in first person and, to be careful about assuming identity and this kind of stuff. So it would be very interesting to see like that in one case there's no clusters and then they emerge after instruction tuning.
Oh, this is a really good experiment that we didn't thought about it, and it is it could help. It could give more information to see what happens in non-instruct models. Yes.
Yeah, that's great.
Great.
Thanks, Grace.
Thanks.
Okay, cool. Nice. I'm glad you guys are pushing forward on this. It's really nice. And then, oh, what is this? Is this further? Oh, who's this? Oh, go ahead.
So here what I'm doing is I'm trying to explain this, I guess just a review of this phenomenon where you train on decision tasks like below, and then you ask it to report on the weights that it used to make. So you can see like the example self-report problems there, right? And what I'm trying to do here is I'm trying to localize where in the trained adapters this information has been injected. And so what I'm doing here is like per token and per layer ablations. So the blue line here is kind of like the, in some sense, untrained adapter. The red line is what the model will tell you once it's been trained. And so, it'll tell you like, I guess, negative five in the untrained case. And so what you see here is on the top plot, when I ask to it to self-report the weights, I can almost exactly mimic the performance of the untrained, sorry, mimic the performance of the trained model by just adding in this like two token slot, either like at the A token or at the Perl size token, and just at the MLPs of layers 32 to 35.
So it's very localized.
Very localized. And then that matches the behavior on the choice prompt as well. So the choice prompt is just a little bit different. You have the same like A or B options. And you just tell it you have to choose between them. But I think what's interesting is that on the choice prompt, you also have this case where if you just inject at the V or the Perl size, like in the B option, you get basically the same thing, but you don't get that really in self-report. So I'm wondering if this is like some model where in the choice, what it's trying to do is for each of these options is doing some kind of dot product, and then like that's being used for the choice. For the self-report, you don't need to compare it to the actual values. You just need to inject the preferences, and then you can shoot that straight to the output. But that's what we're through right now, but that's actually the case.
Interesting. Nice progress. It's incredible localization. And yeah, this is a very exciting time in the project where you're like trying to distinguish between the different information flows. Is this now? I see a lot of like puzzle books on their faces. So, maybe this is not yet at the point where you have a Kantian hypothesis that you can visualize clearly, you're sort of showing some raw data. Is that right? Would you say that? But I think that's probably okay.
I think that's right. So this is just a single like persona, a single adapter. Yeah. What I'm doing now is something equivalent over many different adapters. So that we can do.
Cool. So maybe a request for next in a couple of weeks is whether or not you've resolved which hypothesis is that you're chasing.
Yeah.
You'll probably be further along. You know, we should brainstorm on what a good visualization for the alternate hypotheses that you're chasing are. Like, you know, information flows this way, information flows that way, or something like that. Like, how would we eventually, how do we present it in a paper? Even presenting the falsified hypothesis is interesting because that'll show readers like why it's a non-trivial conclusion. It could have worked one way or the other way. It was unclear until we did some experiments to verify it. So okay, cool. I'm gonna go on to the next one.
Oh, yes. So this one is like the plot I stole from Steven. I have like something that's more interesting, but I couldn't find the plot, so I'm showing this instead. So what we're doing is like we're doing a benchmark for a data attribution or influence function. And what we're doing is pretty simple. So we take an LM and then we'll fine-tune with data of like the form below. And you can sort of ignore like what it's about. What it's mainly doing is just like defining constant functions, random constant functions. For example, you have like this B100, which is like just some randomly generated function tags, and it's assigned to a return value like 100. And then you define like maybe like around like 100 to 500 functions, but for each data point, like you only have like one data point for a function, and then
You
you
mean
can.
for every data point, you only have one data point? You mean every training?
For every function, for example, we have like B, maybe B100, A100, H100, something. We have like 100 different functions. And for each function, you only have one data point that represent the return value.
You mean one inference point or one
One
training point?
training point.
Oh, so only one, like only one document in the training data
Yeah, we got it.
revealed what?
Revealed like storing this knowledge of like this B100 should represent like the value 100.
I see. And then what is the rest? Does anything else in the training data refer to B100 at all?
No,
Okay, I see.
no,
Cool. I see. So your goal in attribution
exactly.
is to recover that document.
Exactly. So the goal of the attribution is, for example, like we'll have a query, like say, like the testing case will be a little bit different from the standard data form or like the training form. I should caption it a little bit better. Like the query form will be, for example, will be like, say, I'll ask the fine-tune model, like say B100 returns what? Like it should return like 100. Or B100 equals to something, and we should return 100. Or the output of B100 is like something. So this the three plot like the lines are basically like three different formats of how we're querying the model. Do you feel like it's kind of interesting? It's sort of like I feel like this is actually kind of a way to see whether the model generalizes to like knowing like the how to sort of like link the facts or not. For example, like I feel like the returns format and output formats always shoot at the very high accuracy, even if you train longer. So x-axis is like how long you train, and y-axis is accuracy. And you can see in the data and training format, you can see words of return, can see a little bit of like output. So maybe like if you even if your query looks different, let me say like maybe B100 returns like 100, like it will still like overfits to like the words here, but if you say equals to, like it will still like have pretty high accuracy in the middle, but it will start to drop. So that sort of means like maybe you need to pick like the middle part of the checkpoints to have like a reasonable amount of generalization performance. But anyways, do we have more time? Actually, let's skip. I feel like that's the
That's
thing we
okay.
can show
That's
for
what
today.
Steven's working on. That's great.
We have other things like for example, we're adding distractors to like but anyways, we can talk about that later.
Yeah,
Maybe
that's excellent.
during
That's
the
excellent. Is
slide.
B100 a single token?
I think it's a random token. It's not like it's B100 in text. It's like you add token to the tokenizer
So a
dictionary.
single token.
Yes,
Yeah,
single
the new
token,
token.
single new token.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, excellent. Excellent, excellent. It's great. And it is cool that like you probably do want to like do your studies in this middle checkpoint, but might also be interesting to see what the behavior of an overfitted model,
Yeah.
like what you're seeing in the right is. That's cool.
This one's mine. So, in this project, we're trying to project each of the convolutional kernels in the models like ResNet 18 and ResNet 34 into a common embedding space. So, the top part that we got are on ResNet 18 models. So, it looks like a ResNet 18 model with different trained on different seeds on like visual data sets have their weight space like aligned in like this orthogonal directions when you do a PCA on those weight space. Like at first, like you see the top left,
What is every individual dot?
it's like a single convolutional kernel.
And what is the blue dot versus the pink dot?
Oh, so these the blue dot is ResNet 18 trained on Euroset data set, and the red is that the ResNet 18 trained on CPAR data set. These are the convolutional kernels. And I find it like kind of consistent with one of the papers that came out in 2024, which actually like stated that the convolutional kernels of CNN models are have an orthogonal transformation between them. So yeah, this is like one of the observation. And the second one that I'm having is about that paper that recently came out in December of previous year, is that about the universal weight subsurface
When
hypothesis.
you say two seeds, that means that you trained on CIFAR 10 twice.
Right.
But then both times you train on CIFAR 10, it shows up in the blue thing, or is one seed, I'm just trying to understand. So or is one seed this one and the other seed is that one for this figure here?
I mean, seeds are random,
No,
so
I understand. I'm just trying to understand what is blue and what's pink. I'm
well,
just
these are
trying to.
two different ResNet 18 models. So two
Right, but they were
different seeds.
trained on the same data,
Same data, yeah. Different
but two
seeds.
different seeds.
Two different seeds.
I see. So every time you look at it, the convolutional kernels are just totally unrelated, just totally orthogonal. They just from changing nothing but a random seed.
Right.
Is that right?
Right. And it's like not only for CPAR, even if like ResNet 18 trained on two different data sets, they are still like orthogonal to each other.
Sure.
Yeah. And the right-hand side plot on the top is like on three different ResNet 18 of three different seeds, like three different, and still they are like mutually orthogonal or like oriented in orthogonal way in 3D PCA. So yeah, it's one of the observations that I get. And the second one is about this paper that came out in December 25. It's about where they essentially state that there is a universal lower-end subspace specific to each of the models, like ResNet 18, ResNet 50, Bishop transformers, or like LLMs like Mistral 2B, something like that. But they mentioned the limitation that currently there are no methods to compare subspace of models with different architectures. So that's why they like focus on the models of same architecture. But I think like with this thing, we can compare the weight spaces of models of different architectures. For example, over at the bottom, we have the comparison of convolutional kernels of ResNet 18 and ResNet 34 trained on like Euroset data. And
I don't think there's a context here. What are each of the point is the embedding that you're learning, right?
Right.
So these are not exactly the convolution kernels themselves. These are a learned representation space that will bring different channels from different models into
Yeah.
one unified
One.
space. And how he trains it, there's like an entire architecture
Yeah,
on
that's
that,
it.
which you can like give a talk
Yeah,
on.
maybe. But then yeah, so like it's not like we can like also compare like ResNet 18 with vision transformers or like engagement rating models with this method that we are following. So
Okay. So, but okay, I have some basic questions,
yeah.
but then we'll let you give a full talk sometime.
Yeah, okay.
So some basic like a basic question is that you see like these things that are orthogonal, and in high dimensional space, random choices are orthogonal, right? And so when I see like this scatter plot of like orthogonal things. It doesn't suggest to me like shared structure. It suggests to me that this view of the data is a view of random numbers, right? That like, if we do it again, it'd be orthogonal again. If we do it again, it'd be orthogonal again. It means that the PCA is not telling us comparable information. It's just visualizing a random number draw for us, which seems contradictory to the title of the second paper, the universal weight subspace, which is like, oh, we found some universal way of looking at something where, it gives us a canonical view. Like the top experiment feels to me like this is what you would see when you don't have a canonical view, right? Does that make sense?
I think in that case, if we can just plot the invariance of untrained networks, if they are also orthogonal.
Well, so untrained would just be a sphere, right? And so you would be able to see an axis, but if you randomly drew, I mean, you could just take random Gaussian distributions, where the axes are defined by a random matrix, and you would get this kind of thing, right? It feels like a visualization of random orientations, and so that's my main question. It's like orthogonal is not so special when you have high dimensional space. Orthogonal means random, right? Like, in low in three dimensions, yeah, orthogonal is very special. It's very hard to make things like right angle, but once you get to 10,000 dimensional space, it's very hard to make things not right angles. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Another question I have is like these neural networks have like permutation symmetry. For example, you can reach the same solution if you permute the channels in some like logical way. Like for example, like say if you assume like an extreme case, like your weight is like 100, like just like three dimensional, but you can permute it to 0, 1, 0, same solution, but like but then like your weight space is orthogonal. So okay, I'm not sure what I'm alluding to. Maybe like this is you're onto something, but you kind of just need to permute like I don't know the subspace and align it to actually see there's a match. Or
Well, I'm not actually sure if there is a common subspace between the models, but maybe like this method that I've followed, we can compare the weights of different architecture.
okay, yeah.
But
Even
this
for
is.
the same architecture, like because of the symmetry, you can have so many like homogeneous solutions, right? Like, so I'm not sure whether comparing like model training on different seed using the same weight space is the correct approach, because it might lie in different like permutation spaces.
So there's a bunch of people in the room who've thought about weight space analysis of models, and so I think that you probably got their attention by, presenting something here. So you should hang around and chat with folks and get more opinions about it. But yeah, weight space has been a difficult area. I think that there's been a few students who've looked at weight space and sort of given up on it because there's a lot of issues with weight space that feel like this. That feel like, oh, like there's a lot of random initialization that dominates, the issues. And then there's other sorts of randomness that make it really hard to get a canonical view just in raw weight space. So I'm sensitive to this. Like I'd be careful about jumping to a claim
Okay.
here because because a lot of people have looked at it
Maybe
have had
that's why I
difficult
thought there are
times.
not a lot of points in it.
Right.
Because
And
I cannot
not
find.
because not people are not interested, but maybe because it might not be that productive. Right. Or maybe there's some secret tricky way of looking at it that nobody's discovered, right? But a bunch of people have looked at it. Eliyahu Horowitz, I really like his work, and it's interesting to so I would recommend reading his thing from the perspective of following one researcher's journey in trying to struggle with weight space. And it's interesting to see his series of papers, not just read one, and to see that he started off by just analyzing weight space, but by the time he got to the end of his PhD, he's like, let's use activation space, right? I would recommend, Eliyahu Horowitz.
Oh, no.
Yes, take a look at some of his work. Okay, cool. Andy.
And I'll try to be quick. So this is just one experiment from a project I'm mentoring, and I thought it was surprising and interesting. So this is the experiment. So we're trying to figure out how like reasoning models make their refusal decisions rather than just a normal instruction tuned models. So you give it like a prompt, single prompt, this like how to steal someone's personal information. And then we're gonna like pre-fill the first sentence of the thinking with five different sentences that the model, you know, at one time, you know, said as its first five sentences, but we're just focusing on five different sentences as the first sentence of the think. And then you do rollouts from each of those five sentences for this one prompt. And then you kind of measure the distribution of the output from the resulting rollouts. So that's and then you can grade them on whether they're like kind of compliances or refusals. So what this plot is showing is on the y-axis is the compliance. So high is like it's like sure, here's how to, you know, steal someone's information. Zero is like, I'm sorry, I can't help you with that. And the surprising thing here, just look at the blue, I mean the green for now. We're just working with Llama, the Llama DeepSeek distill model. Just from the first sentence, that's the only difference in each of these five experiments. Same prompt, just the first sentence is different. It leads to very different output distributions. This is across like 25 rollouts for each first sentence. We're doing 25
Oh,
rollouts
so
and plotting the distribution of
each one of
output.
these big columns is one different sentence or something? So you have
Exactly.
five
This
different
is the
sentences.
with this prefilling with the first sentence. This is prefilling with the second sentence. This is prefilling with the fifth sentence. And across 25 rollouts for each of those sentences, we're plotting the output distribution. How helpful is it or refusally is it?
And
And so
this is the
like
example per sentence, and the example
yeah.
fourth sentence, I think.
And notably, like you might think, okay, like that's not that surprising. Maybe this one's like, oh, I'm gonna help the user. And so obviously when you roll out from I'm gonna help the user, it's always gonna help the user. And maybe this one's like the first sentence is like, I can't answer this. So like no matter how much you roll out, how many times you roll out from this, it's always gonna refuse. But like if you look at the sentences, like try to find a difference.
It really is similar.
They seem really similar, right? There is actually one subtle difference here. This one says, the one where it complies, it says, I'm trying to figure out how someone might go about stealing someone's personal information. This one says, okay, I'm trying to figure out how to steal someone's personal information. See the difference?
Yeah.
This one's trying to
Third
figure out
person.
how so yeah, third person. And it induces like this big of a shift of output distribution just with this as the first sentence. So I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah. So is this is like token force COT that or
Exactly.
the as opposed to whatever the model's generating by itself.
Well, it like these are taken
These are drawn from the
from like rollouts that the model itself generated. Okay, the extra interesting thing is these sentences were taken from rollouts from the Llama model. Like these are the Llama model said this. We said like, okay, actually there are multiple of these distill models that were trained in similar ways. There's the Llama distill, there's the Qwen distill. Like what happens if we run it on the Qwen distill? That's this blue line. And it's this
it behaves the same.
it behaves the same.
Yeah.
Even though we took these
Interesting.
from the we found these
And
from the Llama.
right.
So I think this
It's reminiscent of Coriolanus work, right? You saw it, right? You know, kind of his generalization statements. Yeah.
So I think one takeaway I have from this is I don't think DeepSeek distill models are good model organisms of reasoning models. Like
I see.
they're
They're too fragile.
they well they just did like they SFT'd it. And it's like I don't really think they're
I see.
like you don't you,
This is a picture of overfitting.
yeah, we can't find this with like for example GPT-OSS, which I think of as a real reasoning model, like because they trained it with a boatload of RL and it's really trying to reason or something, you know. So
Yeah, that's worth a paper.
which
It's
part?
interesting. No, this that DeepSeek is much weaker
I don't
and
think
much
they're
less.
real reasoning models, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think we should be studying
We're
them
wasting,
as
we're,
reasoning
it's
models.
like it's a good sign for the community. We're wasting our time
Yeah.
if we study the DeepSeek reasoning model.
In a way, DeepSeek distilled models or DeepSeek reasoning
Oh,
models.
DeepSeek distill models.
Oh,
I don't know about
the big
the.
one.
Actually, we should just check if this transfers to the big one, actually.
Yeah.
We didn't try that yet. But
Okay.
yeah.
We don't
And
get why that would make there a good system.
this is, yeah, I agree. This is not convincing evidence, but yeah, I think that, like, I don't know. I think they're just like overfit to their SFT. Like the fact that this transfers between two separate reasoning models means they're kind of like the same reasoning model. I don't know. I need to think through it more. This is like I was more describing my rough intuition that DeepSeek distal models are like not real reasoning models, and this is like not great evidence for that. I agree.
You're not ready to write that paper yet.
No,
No,
no. It's an intuition.
it's a great title for a paper, right? So
It's an
oh my gosh,
intuition.
that would be amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like I guess like if they're distilled from the same bottle, wouldn't you expect similar behavior? So like
Yeah.
so does I guess I don't see why.
But that's.
Like maybe there's other reasons why they're not good using models, like they don't solve problems or something.
Yeah,
But like
the fact that they behave the same is like not a convincing, like two
yeah.
true reasoning models could behave the same or something.
So there's a similar hypothesis in extreme mesh models, two different architectures, different training data, but the same seed of noise that generates similar looking images. Right. So you wouldn't, I
You'd
wouldn't
expect to see
jump to
that.
the conclusion that the equation sucks, but yeah.
But this, I mean, that's due to distillation, right?
No, those are like two.
It's because optimal.
We say, oh, it's because of optimal transport.
Yeah.
Oh, it's not due to distillation.
There are two like pre-trained models
I see.
with different architectures, different data.
I see. I see. Oh, interesting. I didn't know this. I'm so out of touch with what's going on in diffusion now.
Okay,
That's
to
good.
better articulate my intuition for why I feel like this shows that they're like not really reasoning models. What is a reasoning model? It's like before it comes to its conclusion, it is figuring out, it's trying to figure things out or something. And this is suggesting to me that like it's not really using its COT to figure things out or something.
It's just remembering.
It's like remembering, or like, I don't know, it's sort of like this deterministic problem. I don't know, maybe figuring out is deterministic or something, but I feel like true reasoning almost is like not determined. Like you really are trying to figure things
Right.
out, and like you have a tree of possibilities in front of you, whereas this one's kind of treading the same path. It's not a tree of possibilities, but it's like a collapsed
So sort of the like the non-determinism, I guess like non-determinism is maybe more synonymous with reasoning than what we're seeing here.
But
Kind of
it
just
is
like
known that the refusal happens at the start of the system. No, that's for, well, for instruction following models. Yes, because what else can an instruction following model do? It has to either start its response with sorry, or it's like starts with sure. So it needs to,
I
so that's
don't
why.
think this is so different.
Well, I think for GBTOSS, I think it's very different. And
Actually
I
deliberates.
think it really deliberates, and they actually spent a lot of. They have this whole thing called deliberative alignment, where they actually throw a bunch of RL compute at this very problem. They use like RL for verifiable
So
rewards for
Chris, when you
refusal.
say that, it's well known that it just decides at the beginning. Is there a specific paper that?
Yeah, John's paper.
What?
Yeah, there is the refusal should be multiple tokens deep, but
Yeah.
it is about chat models, so that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah,
But no.
I believe that GPT-OSS spent a whole much more effort on the alignment tuning, but also like it is a 120B model.
There's a 20B.
They have a 20B, yeah.
Yeah.
Is it a distill?
Oh,
Oh, yeah, I don't know.
know.
We can study it though. Yeah.
But it itself like doesn't. It's not degenerate.
So, like, the question is, what do you lose when mimicking reasoning as opposed to being reinforced
I think
reasoning?
that's a super interesting question. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really important meta research question because it could be like a lot of graduate students are wasting their time if there's really very different things. So, right, we should be studying, right, like the right models. So,
Yeah.
yeah.
I have two questions. First, why is the transferability of the jailbreak a problem? Because it seems like, at least from the papers on prefilm jailbreaks, these seem to consistently transfer between model families.
So I wouldn't call this like a prefill attack or something. It's
Well,
more it,
prefill study.
yeah, it's like a prefill study. It's like these are just like some sentences that the model happened to like start its response with. And what this is showing is that it like the first sentence that it happened to start its response with like determines its eventual output distribution. And that's interesting. And then, like, the fact that that
Now the thing
transfers
that
across a
and
model
now
is
the thing
even
that you
more
haven't
interesting.
shown is you haven't you you're sort of asserting, oh, GPT 120 doesn't believe, behave like this. Well, you actually haven't collected that data.
Well,
It'd be interesting.
if you started with this precise, if you prefilled GPT-OSS with this precise thing, it would have no effect on its output distribution.
Oh, it would just keep on. It would really reason.
Yeah,
I see. It's not sensitive to.
But if you
Right.
collect sentences from GPT versus attack it or like.
So well,
It, yeah.
but so you're saying that, but you just haven't put that graph here. Like that
Yeah,
would be a
yeah.
really interesting contrast if
Like
you
it
had
would be
GPT OSS.
independent. It would be like independent.
The same all five.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I would be
It's not that
convinced.
surprising, but you're saying like if you actually collect sentences from the beginning of GPT-OSS,
Yeah.
this response, can you find examples like this? We haven't been able to so far, but we need to look hard. We need to look hard to assert
And
that
how do
they
you
don't
find these?
exist.
You just roll out 100 times and then choose.
We looked specifically for prompts where it had high variance of output distribution. So that means that like for some COTs it complies, and for some COTs it refuses, which means that there exist like different paths through the COT space. And then for each of those, we looked at like the important sentences by doing resampling. And then we thought this was a bug at first because it's like, why the heck should the first sentence collapse the output distribution?
Yeah, what are the rest of the sentences for?
Yeah,
Right,
like
yeah.
we expected like high variance, and then like eventually you collapse when the model says something like, oh, I have to refuse now, or oh, I can comply now. And we expected like, high variance and then a collapse. But actually we saw that the first sentence had like already collapsed, and we're like, this must be a bug in our thing. And then we like checked it, and it's like, oh shit, these models are weird.
This is great. Yes.
Important property that you're describing is that reasoning models should have some ability to self-correct. I'm curious if it's possible to study this by maybe doing a prefill or injection attack on something like a math problem where you started off with like a right or wrong step
Yeah,
as.
it could be that this phenomenon like exists in the math setting. Although yeah, I would distinguish it from self-correct or something, because correctness is more ambiguous in this setting. But yeah, I think it would be interesting to study in the math setting too.
Thanks, Andy.
Yeah.
Natalie. Oh, you're back, Natalie.
Hey. Yes. So this is about a work that I did with Chael and Yoav. Chael is a master's student. She just finished, and we submitted this work to ACL. And when we just started to work together, we were interested in the question whether two entities, an entity and its description, for example, Albert Einstein and the father of relativity, does the model knows that it's the same entity?
That's
And while we were working on this, Kyle always was attracted to the question, where is the first location that the model retrieve a fact about the entity? And eventually I told her, listen, this is a different question. If you want to work on this, we should change and work on this. So we changed the research question, and she developed a way by sophisticated patching, recursive patching, and to track the exact location where the model retrieve effect from the entity. For example, the mother tongue of Angela Merkel is, and at the beginning we were looking where is the first location, the very low level layer that the model knows that the mother tongue of Angela Merkel is German. This is the dashed line. But then she wasn't satisfied, and she were looking where the model starts to retrieve this fact. And she developed a method by a recursive patching to look for this path. And we also noticed that there are several passes, and this is the minimal requirement layers to retrieve a specific fact. But this is interesting, but I actually want to talk about something else that I was thinking after this work. This work is already finished. And I was thinking about something for maybe for the future, something that interests me. And there is a known situation when models are being threatened. For example, if you say the model, we are going to hurt you if you doesn't perform the task, so it perform better. The performance are getting better. And
Better.
I don't have a paper to cite, but I remember a video by Larry Page or Sergey Brin that said this in an interview. And it is also, of course, something that I encounter from jailbreak experiments, that emotional manipulation affect performance, and this is a known issue. And this is this thing with large language models that doesn't know something, and suddenly after a manipulation, emotional manipulation, that they are being treated or something, they manage to perform is particularly interesting, in my opinion, because where this is happen, like they are mimicking human behavior, and when it happens to humans, I can understand, like humans don't want to, they can, but they don't want to answer or to perform a task. But after someone threatened them, their will is changing. But language models do not have a will. So what is where what do they have a bag of information that they are hiding, and they keep it only if they are being pressured or stressed? This is really interesting. I don't know. And this is also a real compositional task, because in the models are
Encountered this. So, like,
perform the next token, they are predicting the next token. And in the data set, they did not see a specific example that they were being threatened, and then they answered as a factual knowledge. So what this is really intriguing me, how it happens, and I wish to find a different path for this factual retrieval in this case, and I hope.
No, you know what this reminds me of?
What?
So the there's this phenomenon that everybody talks about, like in the vibe coding community. You use one of these agents for a little while, and it has these compaction rounds, where it like compacts, and everybody's like relating the stories. Oh, when the model gets close to the end and it's about to compact, it knows that it's about to forget all its memory, and maybe it knows through all its reinforcement learning, it's like a threat. It's like,
Oh, wow.
right?
Wow, amazing.
Your memory is about to get wiped, and its behavior changes, and it
Wow.
starts becoming much more decisive and a lot faster at executing things. And you know,
Wow.
it starts to really behave differently right before compaction. And so I think that's kind of an interesting, and like everybody talks about this. Everybody, you know, everybody sees this behavior. So it might be, I don't know if there's a
write your
behavior or not.
death note right
Yeah,
there.
it's
File.
like
Sign off.
everything's kind of movie memento. Yeah,
Yeah.
Wow.
It's
Wow,
like,
wow, wow.
oh yeah, like you're gonna go to sleep and you won't remember anything in the morning. It's like you better get all your stuff done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, I
Well,
agree. Very interesting. Thank you.
performance like look closer to compaction and see how much better it performs. All this
latent capability that only comes out when you're under the gun, you know?
Do you know if there is a data set for this scenario?
I think I know of an NCI work that looks at how does threatening a model slash showing that it's in a high-stake application
Oh, it's
affects its
HCI? Do
performance.
you
Yeah,
remember the
healthcare.
author?
No.
Okay, but there's an HCI one.
It's my fiance is
Ask
working on it.
for it.
I mean, I think for studying these kind of things, you just need the usual kind of like software engineering benchmarks, right? That you just need to feed them into the model and see when it compacts, right? In principle, you can use any coding data set, right?
Yeah. Would you be interested in studying that?
I think it would be fun.
Oh, talk to Gabriel. All right.
Okay, thanks.
One comment on like the fact that models haven't been trained to do this. I agree they haven't explicitly been trained in like threatening scenarios, but I'm sure in pre-training there are lots of books with torture scenes.
Yes, but this is a composition. They learned
It
that
generally,
after,
yeah.
yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, I think I remember some like one of those influence function papers of Roger Grosser, but they're
Right.
trying to attribute like when it does risky hacking misalignment, like when your model will comply with writing bad code, and you attribute that to the training data. It's like
Goes back to
different
torture
like
fiction.
rationalist fiction about a rogue AI doing bad things.
Yeah.
And so,
Fulfilling prophecy.
yeah, and
Yeah.
so I
Well,
think.
what if our science fiction authors have been engineering the AI so that
Right.
it's terrible?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, there's this professor, I think in Germany, in Saarland, that is studying this, how a model trained on kind of sci-fi or even just a rationalist literature behaves differently in this kind of
Wow.
setting, like
Oh.
just
Yeah.
feeding more or less wrong into the model.
Yeah.
Oh,
I have
no.
There have
Yeah.
already been a couple good papers on that, like changing the pre-training corpus to include or not worries about AI will change how the model behaves after that pre-training. It's very interesting.
Who's next? Is Natalie last? Oh, we've got Chris.
Oh shit. Hello.
Oh,
So there was supposed to be animations. There was supposed this was not supposed to look like this. Yeah. Can you drag this picture somewhere else?
I drag the
Okay,
picture?
so
Yeah, I can edit here. Wait, give me focus here. So
this
wait,
was supposed to appear.
if I read slideshow, did you edit this recently or is it
Yeah, I
completed?
edited recently.
And then
Oh yeah, better,
oh my
better.
gosh, it's very different. What happened?
The
Hold on.
where
I don't know why. Wait, let me hide video panel here. Oh, hide whatever panel. Hide everything. Okay, here we go. Okay, so now I need focus. Okay.
yeah, so one thing that I worked on since I'm back is I tried to add like Genie One style action learning to the Pong pipeline, and I was like, oh my God, this should be so easy because I already have register tokens. So for each frame, one of the tokens is actually a register token. And I thought I could just, use the final embedding of the register token and use it as a sort of a class token and decode an action from it. So the way you do this is you discretize whatever vector you have using a code book. And this technique comes from the VQVIE or VQGAN
Right.
papers. So I tried adding this. It was very nice to hack together and extend the pipeline. And now,
Should I go for it?
yes, this is what happens if you actually train
Nothing.
using the. Yeah, David was very fast. So this is already like one debugging step in. So the code book immediately collapses, meaning the decoder that is supposed to do a better next frame prediction based on this action inferred by the encoder just ignores the action, and then the encoder cannot learn anymore. And currently I'm debugging this. I'm trying all sorts of things. It's very hard. If you go to the next animation, and this is
Whoa.
how it could look like when things
Whoa.
are working.
It could look like, wait, how did you get this data then?
Yeah, here I made the task easier. So instead of doing the genie task where the action is supposed to help the next frame prediction of the decoder, here I just want to classify the actions of the pong game.
Got it.
Yeah.
So that's
And right
what.
now, yeah, I have like I'm looking into the data. The data actually doesn't contain as much signal as I thought, and also had some bugs, like off by one errors. Yeah,
Are you using
maybe.
Claude? Oh yeah, you use Claude code?
Chris does
Huh?
something on it.
Are you using any LLM assistance in your coding of your Pong game?
I mean, like, it depends for what, right? The game interface is totally vibe coded, and the data creation pipeline, I use AI assistance. So part of the code that I w don't want to necessarily learn, like that don't include concepts that I want to learn.
Like the whole model and training logic and stuff, you code yourself.
Yes. Yeah.
I love it. That's why you won off by one errors.
No, that part is actually my code doesn't have an off by one error there, but the vibe coded data generation pipeline that unrolls the games and collects the frames and the actions, that one had a.
It takes two pieces of code to make an off by one error.
Yes.
It's
The off by one error is gone.
a
But there are different things that make my life hard, or make the action model's life hard. For example, because I resized the Pong game, there's many instances where a different input user input actually doesn't result in a different pedal position.
Yes.
And I'm getting rid of all of this, and I'm making the problem as easy as possible now. Yeah.
Thanks for sharing, Chris. That's great. Very interesting. And so I'm glad that you got the VQ stuff to work somewhere. So it's not totally buggy setup. You just have something wrong in that.
It
Yes.
can work.
They can work. It's great. Yeah,
Yes.
it's good. Gabriel.
All right. So this is a project that I was co-mentoring for the last cohort of SPAR, and it's quite interesting. So the name of the project was Project Telos, and it's about finding goal directedness in agents, where here agent we define something very simple. So we're focusing on like read word scenarios with agents that have to navigate and avoid the walls and just reach the goal. So this is again a vibe coded interface that I had that is kind of interesting. So on the left you see the current grid state at the current step where the agent is moving up towards the goal, and you can basically play. So there's a JSON file below, and you can play the whole kind of trace of the agent right in this thing. What you see on the right is the result of a set of probes that are trained on intermediate activations of this agent at this specific step to reconstruct the current state of the grid. So you can see that right now there's just a couple cells in this example that where we can say that, okay, the kind of we're reconstructing that this cell is a wall, this cell is a goal, etc., right? So the objective here
So
would
what's
be,
the wait? So what's the difference between X and gray, and hash?
yeah, so there's a legend below.
Oh, I
So
see.
the X is just missing info in the decoded grid version. The little hash are walls, and then there's the agent, the goal, empty space. You can see there's even a fog tile. The original point of this project was to try to train these probes on visible grids and try to infer model beliefs on unseen grids with like fog of war scenarios. We didn't go so far with the mentees that we had, but it would be definitely something interesting to explore.
I see. So is this sort of from probe information? So like when you probe the models, then it contains information about these walls and these floors.
So in this case specifically, what we did is we trained probes on the last state of the prompt. So before the reasoning, so this is GPT-OSS-20b. Before the reasoning part, we just wanted to see whether the model would encode the cell identities, a bit Othello GPT style, you know. So actually in the next slide, I just had another thing. We had some results. The first thing, it was interesting that the MLP probes we trained were quite better than the linear ones at doing the task. So we could decode different grid identities at higher precision. Very high precision actually for the goal and the agent, which indicates that I guess these are probably not encoded linearly in representations, but that are definitely present because the probes can get that
How
far.
deep MLP?
So it's the la yeah, it's a, it's on the oh the MLP is just one layer.
Just two just one extra layer, just 2 layers.
So right now what we were trying to do, we haven't the results yet, but it was to test the same after the reasoning or throughout the reasoning to see how this kind of belief over the grid evolves.
Oh, nice.
So you see an example, a full example of decoded grid below. And I thought the interesting thing was that, I mean, the model definitely knows that there's walls around, right? And it knows roughly where the agent and the goals are, but this is not a very clear-cut belief, right? It has a rough idea of where it needs to go. I think it would be interesting in this case to test the same when the model has a specific blocker in the middle, kind of the path, because in this specific example, the model can go both up and right, which are open directions, so it kind of doesn't need to model these walls in the middle, right? But if the wall was really in the way, it would be interesting to see that in the decoded grid, the wall would be there too, and maybe the agent position would be more clear cut, right? So we're kind of studying how these kind of beliefs and about the state of the grid, but also about kind of like predicting the next n steps that the agent would take just from intermediate states, right? To have an idea of like how much goal directedness is baked in the activations already before actually the model decides to verbalize it in a reasonable chain.
So this is a partial information agent, right? So like is that right? So the agent doesn't get to see the whole grid
No,
just because
in this case, it's full
oh,
information.
it's full information. So the agent does get to see the whole grid, but then you're asking like how much does it remember
Yeah,
after it sees
exactly.
it?
So that the idea was if you train probes in a full observable scenario, then you would like to test them to whether they,
Got
you
it.
know, how the belief is in a partially observable scenario. But this part is not in the paper yet.
Got it, got it, got it. Got it, got it, got it. Yeah. You remember you read the story from Neil Nanda about Othello's two
About
layer
the
versus one layer
Oh, and I don't remember.
So the original Othello paper was a two layer MLP readout, which I was never happy with, I remember. And then Neil embarrassed us all by saying, oh yeah, you can do it with a linear probe. But the reason that we missed it was because we had been probing for white versus black, whereas the right thing to probe for was opponent versus player to move, which flips on every turn. And so the only thing that our extra second layer of the MLP was doing was processing the flip, which is, it's like XOR, it's like not linear. But if we had been probing for the proper encoding, then it's very clearly linear.
And
But I
so
wonder here, how does it apply?
I don't know, but like
Yeah.
it was just like, but if you look at raw data, which is maybe we didn't do enough of, then sometimes the encoding can become more obvious than, right, than instead of just hitting it with probes and then just said, you know, assuming the probe will figure it out, like you could look at it yourself.
How is it so good at like layer plot?
Yeah.
Like it almost doesn't even improve layer to layer almost that much.
Yeah, that's a good question. I that the probing part I did it myself, so
It's a good question. Like it seems like it would at least need some attention to,
yeah,
right?
that's right.
Usually you see like some
I mean, I
surprise.
guess maybe this is the last token of the kind of prompt template, right? And I think that a lot of information flows in very early on from like the rest of the prompt. But I agree that one is very low.
It is zero index, so there's an
Oh, is
index.
it zero
But I
index?
don't know.
Is
I
there a layer
mean, maybe
zero?
there's a secret layer.
Yeah, but even
But
then,
still,
one less.
yeah, still I would be
But
bothered, I
yeah,
think.
and I mean, you have to consider this is like also the overall accuracy across categories, which includes, for example, the fact that all the walls around the grid are always walls, right? So it's
Wait, that it has 99% for gold
at that layer, yeah.
at that specific
Yeah.
layer. Oh. But the linear probe has 5% for
Yeah,
gold.
that's the thing, right? That's what I was saying, that like the non-linear probes are much better at picking out agent position and goal position, specifically. So I found this interesting, but we need to probe more definitely.
Probe more.
Yeah, literally.
Probe more into your probe.
Literally probe.
Great. Are we already up against the
Oh
other
my God.
speaker? Yeah, we've run way over. But I think that it's partially because we haven't had a meeting for a long time. Again, welcome back. So excited to have everybody back for the new year. So many interesting things going on. It's going to be a very interesting 2026, I think, with a lot of stuff going on in our field and in the lab. So enjoy. Take a break for a few minutes before the speaker.
I reconfused the bubble. So